Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mainly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clarke and back for a third appearance in the book club. It's an extremely warm welcome return to Garth Ennis. Garth, welcome back.
Thank you, Eamon. It's a pleasure to be here.
No, well, it's really great. Now, we sort of trailed this one. I think regular listeners will know that you had a particular story that you wanted to cover, and we were waiting for a second volume to be released by the Treasury, which it now has done. Tell us, what have you picked to come back on the book club with?
The story is The Sarge by Jerry Finley Day and Mike Western. It has, as you say, been collected in two volumes by Rebellion. But it's one of Battle's longer stories. It ran for a good, in this form anyway, it ran for a good 100, 120 issues, something like that. It was continued later after Finley Day and Western moved on by Scott Goodall and Phil Gascoigne. But that was quite a different strip. The one we're talking about today, the one that Rebellion have collected, really is a classic Battle story. Two of the creators at their best.
So these are, as you say, two volumes from Rebellion. These are collecting stories that ran in Battle from June 1977 to December 1978. Two lovely hardbacks I've got here in front of me. Both of them you've got, you've done the introduction for both volumes. Mm-hmm. We'll mention quickly that in the back of the both volumes we've got some covers by Mike Western and a couple of other interesting artists that we might mention briefly as we go along. Also, the first volume's got an afterword by Mike Western's son, Peter, who I was having a pint with not all that long ago, actually, who describes some of his father's sort of working routine, which was great stuff. And then there's also tucked in the back of issue of volume two, you've got the story you did with PJ Holden in the 2022 Battle Action Special.
Right, yeah, which is, I think, very much a tribute to what Jerry and Mike did.
And it's very much, right in the middle of these sort of this run of stories, it feels like. Anyway, it feels like it fits in there. Now, 1977, 1978, if I remember rightly, Garth, this was somewhere about when you started with Battle. Is that right? Started reading it?
I would have come in somewhere early in the second half of the run. Early summer of 78, I suppose, when the section are making their way up through Italy. And that was when I started with what was then Battle Action.
And, I mean, obviously we've got these two great creators that we're going to talk about. We've got this solid run now collected in these two volumes. What was it particularly about the story that sort of grabbed you, that you particularly wanted to talk about?
I think, on the one hand, you have the excellence of the artwork. What the art helps to bring alive, I think, is the excellent characterization in what is one of Battle's better team stories. You have a section or squad of British infantry. Now, the cast changes quite frequently due to fatal circumstances. But there's generally 10 to 12 guys in this section. They're led by a veteran, I think, of the First World War, Sergeant Jim Masters, the titular Sarge. What I see the Sarge as, first and foremost, is, as I say, a really good team story. And it's, in those terms, surprisingly gimmick-free for a battle strip of the time. The team are not doomed and damned being led into the heart of darkness like Darkie's mob. They're not brutal criminals, each with his own specialty like Rat Pack. What they are just ordinary British soldiers. The men who took the British Army through World War II, I suppose. And as I said, it's gimmick-free. It if it has one, I suppose, aspect in that regard, it's Master's leadership. It's the idea that this wily veteran soldier who's been given the job of getting a squad of men through the war will do everything he can to keep his squad alive. They survive long enough for us to get to know them, the different personalities, quirks, and so on. And as such, I think it works admirably in that regard as not a documentary, but a very down-to-earth story, not about vicious killers or special forces, but about ordinary guys. And that, if you think about it, is quite rare for British comics of the era, especially battle action, where usually they did need some hook. Here it's just good storytelling.
And you're absolutely right, because the characters that these two creators give us, they're just so likeable. And as you say, they seem so ordinary, don't they? Ordinary blokes dealing with extraordinary circumstances. You mentioned, obviously, that the second volume mostly deals with their advance up through Italy. Just quick, what are the other theatres of war that the Sarge and his section are involved in these collections?
Yeah, this is where, in broad terms, the Sarge does give you, at least in terms of location, a reasonably accurate portrait of the British Army's journey through the Western theatre of operations. They started getting kicked out of France. They arrive in North Africa. You then get 2 to 3 years of the weird back and forth war that developed there, where the Italians advanced against the British. The British pushed them back. The Germans arrived and pushed the British back. The British launched an offensive, which pushed the Germans back a bit. The Germans then forced them nearly all the way back to Egypt. And then finally, the British pulled it round at El Alamein, and with the help of the Americans, managed to shove the Germans and Italians all the way west to Tunisia and then out of Africa. After that, they hop over to Sicily. That lasts about a month. Then they're into Italy. That proves to be a much tougher campaign than anyone expects. But when we leave the section at the end of the Finlay Day Western run, they are at, I suppose, one of the turning points of the Italian campaign, as the main force links up with the beachhead that was established at Anzio. After that, they'll be able to advance on Rome. I mentioned the continuation by Scott Goodall. That was where you saw the section then move to France for the Normandy campaign, through the Low Countries and into Germany. But we're only concerned with the part of the story that ends in Italy.
So let's get to our creator talk and talk first of all about Gerry Finlay Day. Amazingly prolific in the 70s and 80s. I know you're a big advocate of his because he's one of the names that perhaps doesn't quite get the recognition that he deserves as a writer at this time.
I think that's true. Gerry really passed out of comics in the mid-80s and has only been seen rarely since. He is of that generation that I think Pat Mills and John Wagner learned a great deal from when they were putting Battle and later Pat with Action in 2000 AD together. I think what they learned from Gerry in particular was, given that he'd worked on girls' comics so much, that if boys' comics were going to change and evolve and succeed, because Seals were slipping at the time, and that's why Battle and Action in 2000 were so necessary, then they were going to have to take a sort of a leaf out of the girls' comics book as established by Gerry and start focusing on characterization and not just character creation followed by meaningless violence and adventure. There had to be more focus on character. And that's what Pat and John learned from Gerry. And I think they learned that lesson and expanded and developed it hugely. In frank terms, I would say that both Pat and John are better writers. But it is interesting that in that regard, Gerry was their starting point. And I think Pat in particular has acknowledged that, the importance of what Jerry showed them. He was essentially an ideas man. Like many writers in comics of that era, he relied on volume. You'll see his name a lot, as you say. He's very good at coming up with hooks for characters. So Hellman, the German tank officer who tries to fight a clean war, the Sarge, the one we're talking about, many other German strips like Fighter from the Sky and Panzer G-Man. In 2000 AD, of course, the VCs, Rogue Trooper, Harry 20. His execution can be a bit clunky, but as an ideas man, you really can't fault him. He's something special, I think.
And you've already mentioned one of the things he does so well in The Sarge is give us this cast of characters, which obviously there is an attrition rate, but he gets us to care for the characters. The section that Jim Masters is in charge of, would it slightly, you know, come in and go in cast because of, as you say, fatal attrition. But Jerry Finley Day makes us care about these blokes the whole time, doesn't he?
Yes, I think so. Some of them are with the Sarge very nearly the whole way through. Most obviously, Big Sid, the Bren gunner. The others join the section as you go, and each of them will have some little quirk. Beetle Bailey, Beat, the radio man, has a peculiar sixth sense that serves the section well from time to time. We are not talking superpowers here. We're simply talking about hairs go up on the back of the neck whenever there's trouble. Bully Bates, well, speaks for himself. Piat Pete, the anti-tank specialist who's terrified of tanks and who also has a stammer. There's a little sort of lesson in that episode, like don't mock the afflicted kind of thing. Lover Boy Lovett, one of my favorite characters who's something of a narcissist. Big hit with the ladies, always combing his hair and not paying attention when he should and getting into trouble. And of course, Unknown Soldier. Unknown Soldier isn't a likable character. I think he's given the name Unwin, but he's always referred to as Unknown Soldier. He's not likable, but he clearly has something going on there, some secret in his past that makes him so ruthless and cold-blooded. And then you have the Sarge himself, who's this very kind of fatherly or favorite uncle character, who's the guy who'll always come up with the answers, who'll always come up with some way to get the section out of the trouble that they've gotten into. And they come to rely on him, and I suppose for the brief time that they're allowed to, they flourish under his leadership. He's the guy that gets them through, or at least gets them a certain way up the road.
And Jerry Finley Day's got 3 pages a week. He's got to, you know, tell a story and give us a resolution. I noticed from your introductions that, of course, some of the resolutions that the Sarge himself uses perhaps stretch credulity somewhat in their use of weapons and so on, because he has to get them out of a tight spot always. But, you know, it's great fun the way that Jerry Finley Day does this and manages to get each week resolved.
I think so. I said that the strip itself, its actual creation and the engine that drives it, is gimmick free because it's very simple, that they survive because they listen to him and he gets them through. But when you look at the resolution of each storyline, the gimmicks start coming hard and fast. There's always some object or item that can be used to get them out of trouble. They're in a minefield. There's a knocked out tank. Well, they pull metal chains off the tank and start lashing them ahead of themselves to explode the mine safely. That wouldn't work, but it's an example of what I'm talking about. There are many more. They do stretch credulity, no doubt about it, as to certain other aspects of the strip, but they work. And because the strip doesn't have the kind of brutality that some of the others in the comic have to rely on. Maybe that's what forces Jerry into this corner, and sparks his creativity as a result. If you were to follow the fortunes of a British infantry unit through these campaigns that I've described, and you saw the attrition that they suffered, and you saw how they get in and out of trouble, the truth would be not more mundane, but from the point of view of a boys' comic audience in the 70s, probably a bit less engaging, because it would be run into the enemy. Hopefully you've ambushed them, but if you haven't and you're in trouble, you shoot back, you keep them at bay, you get on the radio, you call for an airstrike or artillery, or just some support from the rest of the larger unit that you're part of, and hopefully that's what keeps you alive. Now, although that would be very interesting from the point of view of a military historian, it's not going to work in a boys comic in the 70s, and that is why Jerry reaches for his book of tricks, I suppose.
Now, the one thing that I noticed when I was reading it this time, which was my first time of reading these stories, was despite the sort of slightly gimmicky trick endings to some of the episodes, on the whole, as well as this wonderful depiction of characters, we also get, I thought, a quite wonderful depiction of the importance of competence in extreme circumstances. And of course, I know, I think you mentioned this in the panel you did at the Bedford Convention recently, that obviously Band of Brothers, both the book and the TV series, sort of gave us, again, you know, in that case, a very real company who proceeded through several theatres of war. Do you think that's one of Jerry Finley Day's other strengths as well? I mean, I'm thinking also of Hellman, where he displays this sort of competence, the experienced soldier actually being able to get through certain situations.
I think so. It's interesting that in The Sarge, there is no question that the men will listen to Jim Masters. In some of the others, like Hellman or Fighter from the Sky, our hero has a lot of trouble persuading people to listen to him. Hellman is constantly up against Nazis who think they know better. Fallman, the guy from Fighter from the Sky, has been disgraced. And yet, if anyone who does listen to them will probably survive. We see the Sarge again and again pull something out of his hat, and it's, we know really that it's Jerry just racking his brains and coming up with anything from innovation to outright nonsense, but it's played as only the Sarge would have this idea. Only the Sarge has that tactical acuity. He sees something that other people don't. So yeah, that's probably a vital part of the strip's success.
And I was also very taken with another thing you wrote in one of the introductions, that you described this, you know, Jim Masters, the Sarge, he's got a job, not a mission. And he's obviously very good at his job, and that seemed very important. I also liked how he, because the people who join the section are often not very good at it to begin with, but they get better under his sort of guidance and tutelage, which I thought was another bit of wonderful writing from Jerry Finley Day, that the characters change and grow, which is fantastic.
Yeah, I think so. In that sense, it's a nice, if slightly basic, portrayal of what a sergeant or an NCO, non-commissioned officer, is supposed to do, which is he's given this group of disparate personalities and he's supposed to mold them together into a successful unit. Masters, and with the aid of Jerry's book of tricks, as I've described it, is just a slightly exaggerated version of that. But I suppose it's the simple idea of someone with enough authority, personality, to impose that on a group of people and get them to work as a team, making them understand that they work together, they've got a chance, they don't, they haven't.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's fantastic writing from Jerry. I just loved it. Let's turn, of course, to the artwork, which we can also wax lyrical about. Mike Weston, who sadly passed away in 2008, this was the strip that he moved on to after doing Darkie's Mob with Jom, of course. Now, this, I think, if I remember rightly, Garth, you'll correct me on this, this comes before his HMS Nightshade work in Battle.
That's right. It sits between them.
Yeah.
Darkie's Mob to the Sarge, then issue 200, It's All Change, and Mike goes on to HMS Nightshade, while the Sarge continues, and at that point it's the handover to Goodall and Gascoigne. Or Gascoigne later, there's another artist who does a few episodes. But yes, this is Mike Western's longest strip for Battle. I think Darkie's Mob and Nightshade both last about a year, whereas this goes a bit longer.
So it's mostly black and white. Of course, occasionally, I think in the first volume, we see the strip occasionally get the colour centre spread, and sometimes I think a colour back page. But it's mostly three pages of black and white artwork a week. I mean, the obvious question, Garth, is what do you make of Mike's work on The Sarge?
I think it's tremendous. I really do. I'm a huge Western fan to begin with. I've always thought there's a tremendous authority to Mike's ink line. When you look at it, even when he perhaps makes the occasional error, even when his hardware, for instance, isn't 100% accurate, he's drawn a good enough approximation of it to begin with and finished it off with that incredibly powerful ink line so that you are in no doubt that what he's drawn cannot be mistaken for anything else. Everything from the equipment that the section carry, which isn't quite right, but is unmistakably what it's supposed to be, to if you look at the ship in HMS Nightshade, it's a Corvette. It's a lot shorter and stubbier than it would be in real life, but he's making it work the way he needs it to, with, again, that tremendously powerful ink line. The other aspect of Mike's work that I think is so important is character. And the group in the section are, I think, quite wonderful. You cannot mistake Jim Masters for anybody else, or Big Sid, or Little Beetle, or The Unknown Soldier, or Lovett. They are all undoubtedly who they are. And the degree of emotion he brings to their faces, I think, is wonderful. There are so many moments where he makes sequences work just by imbuing his figures and faces with that emotion. I always remember towards the end of the strip when they've been ambushed by German tanks and infantry, and Bully Bates is freaking out, convinced he's going to be blown up by a grenade, and Piat Pete, far more calm and a little grim, seems to find his moment. He seems to find it in himself to face his destiny, and he quietly says, no, it won't be a grenade, and of course it's going to be a tank, because Pete's always been terrified of tanks. And Pete's heroism then drives Bates on to do something equally heroic. Mike makes all this work in a way that a lesser artist couldn't. He carries it through in the faces, and he creates tremendous atmosphere too. And in that same episode, which is part two of a two-part story, the section have probably unwisely been to see a fortune teller who tells them that one of them will die in the sand in which they fought. So, and they all relax because they're in Italy. You can't die in the sands of the desert when you're in Italy. But of course, they've forgotten the Sirocco, the wind that blows the Sahara sands across the Mediterranean to Italy, and they end up in a sandstorm. So there's quite a spooky, creepy feeling about that one that Mike brings through as this ostensibly ridiculous prophecy looks as if it's going to come true, and does in an odd way. All this, Mike seems to take in his stride.
It's absolutely wonderful. I mean, like yourself, I'm very taken with the fact that he makes all the characters instantly recognizable, and then also that he can stick with it. You know, they stay, they say the faces stay recognizable throughout. I do love a page when you get like the cast of characters with their headshots at the top of a title page as well, which is very that's nice,
even though sometimes you see those faces and they're hovering over graves.
There's a
nice moment towards the end when the Sarge makes a deal with his commanding officer to get the last few survivors of the section transferred out of the front line. And in exchange for that, he's going to do a one-man job for the commanding officer. Now, that's nonsense. That couldn't happen. You can't make deals like that. But the Sarge sets off on his own and is instantly ambushed. And right when he's thinking that he could do with some help against these Germans, the sections show up and save him. And he realizes that they got off the train he had them put on and came after him, and now they're together. And it's the one and only time you really see Masters lose his temper, because after having seen so many of his section killed and failed, I suppose, in what he might see as his duty to get them through, he thinks he's figured out a way to actually come good and save these guys' lives. And now, finally, they've gotten around his best intentions. And he screams at them, "You bunch of idiots, I wanted you out of Italy." And it's Mike really makes it work, because he's livid. You've never seen him like this. At last, the Sarge, the only people who could make him lose control are his own pig-headed guys. And I think it's Big Sid who just laughs at him. And at that point, it's like, well, you've got us, whether you like it or not. We're stuck with each other, so let's keep going. And of course, that takes the section to eventually to a very dark place. You know, in a way, they've, with the best of intentions, they've doomed themselves. But you buy it anyway. You sort of because Mike and Aunt Jerry have made you believe in these characters and their devotion to one another, you buy it and you think, yes, it makes sense that they would do this. It's exactly what they would do. They'd stick together to the end.
And I'll just mention that the Sarge himself, of course, always has his pipe gripped between his teeth, instantly recognisable, and perhaps not too dissimilar from Mike Weston himself. We know certainly from his depiction of Grandad in the HMS Nightshade stories.
I think the pipe is a nice touch, because it gives him a sort of grandfatherly, or what I called earlier, a favourite uncle appearance. You know, there's a sort of level of comfort there. The guy who's calmly smoking on his pipe, like an elderly relative who's always relaxed and always calm. And in a way, it's misleading, because Masters can be quite vicious and dangerous when he has to be. But I think it's the kind of picture he would prefer to show to his men, just to inspire their confidence.
It all works brilliantly in terms of, you know, Mike Weston's wonderful art and Jerry's great stories. It's a fantastic two-volume collection. What did you make of Peter Weston's notes about Mike's inking techniques? I think he says that his dad did very loose roughs in pencil and then was sort of like extreme detail and attention to detail with the inks. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, that in a way that goes back to what I was saying about the authority of his line. And it's also interesting, because later on in HMS Nightshade, where Mike is only inking half of each episode and less as he goes on, and I believe it's Ron Tyner who's inking the other pages, it doesn't work because Mike's pencils don't have enough Mike in them. And so when Ron Tyner comes along, he is less to work with. And the pages have, sadly, a sort of sloppy quality that you just don't see in any other Western artwork. And you'll be reading HMS Nightshade, and it is a shame that it happened on that strip, because that's, to me, that's one of the all-time greatest battle stories, where the first two pages are wonderful, they're flawless, and the last two just don't stack up, because you've got another artist, very talented guy, Ron Tyner, with a very different style, just not getting enough of Mike Western in those pencils to make the pages look right.
I'll mention on a similar theme that in the first volume here, I think we get Mike Dory inking for one episode. And then we also get an episode drawn by Jim Watson, mm-hmm. An artist who I've recently developed a deep appreciation for as well. But it's Mike Western who sort of steals the show throughout these two volumes, isn't it?
Oh, yes, it's his story.
Yeah.
Unquestionably. We're really talking about fill-ins. Mike Dory's stuff looks like Mike Dory, unquestionably. Because he has probably a stronger ink line of his own than Ron Tyner, the pages do look a bit more like Mike Western. Jim Watson, of course, he does 2-3 episodes, possibly. And, of course, he's penciling and inking. Mike's not involved in those issues. But I like Jim Watson a lot as well, actually. His stuff got a bit shakier the older he got, but he was a very good war comics artist. He did a lot of great stuff on Battle. He did a lot of issues of Hellman as well, which worked very well. And, of course, he did Colony Earth for 2000 AD, which was, I think, Independence Day before there was Independence Day. No, I've always liked his stuff a lot. I think he's very, I suppose people would say Marmite, but I think he's terrific.
Mike Western's covers appear in colour in the backs of the books. But also, I just quickly mention again that we noted that there's at least two other well-known 2000 AD artists who did a cover for The Sarge.
Mm-hmm.
We've got one, Carlos Esquerra, and then we've got, I think you've mentioned it was Mick McMahon's only work for Battle.
Right, yeah. Carlos did a lot of not generic covers for Battle, but certainly covers that weren't involving his own characters, like Easy or El Mestizo or those. Carlos, of course, had that ability to turn his hand to anything. And if anyone can handle a sort of group of infantry guys or infantry action, it's him. As for the McMahon one, yeah, that's Mick's one and only work for Battle Action, and it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, it's a fantastic cover. He apparently is a big war comics fan, Mick, I should say. He grew up on Joe Kubert and people like that. The funny thing is, if you read The Cursed Earth, it's interesting to see how many of the mutants are armed with Second World War firepower, like quite obviously so. I'm surprised he didn't do more, but maybe it was just a case of them keeping him busy on 2000 AD, where his talents were probably best employed. But it was nice to see this one little curio, and it was nice that it was on the Sarge.
Fantastic stuff. So, Garth, let me give you all the artwork that's contained within these two volumes. And actually, we were talking about this before we started recording, that we don't think very much of this artwork, if any, survives. I was looking for some on Comic Art Fans and couldn't find any. And you mentioned that it later on with Battle, it becomes important that they start hanging on to the artwork for relettering and reprinting. But this was probably before that, wasn't it?
Yeah, I got in touch with Mike Western about 25 years ago, at the same time as I reached out to John Cooper. And I bought pages off both of them, Johnny Red from John and HMS Nightshade from Mike. Mike only had two pages from Nightshade, but I noticed all of this stuff was hand-lettered, where in their original runs in Battle Action, it was machine-lettered. And because there's so little battle action or just battle art about, my suspicion is that if any of it was going to survive, it would have been the stuff that was snagged to be hand lettered for reprint in battle, sort of in that 84 to 86 period, when they're relying more and more on reprinted material. I think at that point in the comic, the only originals are Johnny Red and Charlie's War. Everything else is the Action Force stuff, or it's an old strip reprinted. And you see Nightshade, you see the Sarge, you see Fighting Man. Later, you see Johnny Red and Charlie's War when the thing becomes almost fully reprint. And I think that's how that art survived. I think it was because because it had been preserved and relettered, it got it into that period where art was being returned to artists. I think in that effort that Robin Smith began with 2000 AD. I mean, glad it did, but it does mean that there's so much stuff that I guess is just lost to posterity. If there are any Johnny Red pages by Joe Calhoun, I've never heard of them. So many others lost as well, from the kind of beginning of the comic through to, say, what, 1980-81. A damn shame. But I don't know, maybe it all went in the big IPC incinerator. Yeah,
one of the great tragedies of British comics always, the subject of lost artwork. But anyway, let's pretend that the artwork still exists and that we could afford it. What page have you chosen from these two volumes as your grail?
Okay, so if you go towards the end of the second book, and it's the third to last episode, and the first page has the Sarge and Lovett and Unwin and Beat and Big Sid waiting to cross a very busy highway, which is just loaded with German traffic. They're a long way behind the lines, and they're trying to make it through to Anzio, the beachhead that's been established in the near Rome. And they're waiting their turn to cross this highway. It's night. That'll give them a chance, but they're all pretty nervous. They're all on edge. They're waiting their turn. They're going to run between the high-speed vehicles. And you see, in the first panel, you see them waiting and judging their moment. And I think it's a fantastic character piece, seeing five of them. There's only five of them left at this point. Seeing them waiting there, about to risk their lives yet again. It's a nice group shot. It's a great emotional moment out of many, many wonderful Western pages on the Sarge. I think I would go for that one.
It's a fantastic image, fantastic page. You've also got what I think is the best version of the Sarge logo on that page as well.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And it just shows this sort of moment of sort of almost, this is slightly less gimmicky soldiering in a way, isn't it? Just waiting for a gap to run across the road.
Yes, I think so. It's a nice moment in what is a story made up of, well, the adventures of ordinary people, exhibiting what I sometimes think of as the heroism of endurance. You're not on a secret mission. You're not going to blow up a rocket lab. You're not going to assassinate a Nazi officer. It's your job to just show up in the line again and again and again. And it's the lot of the infantry. It's the same as a tank crew, a bomber crew, a ship's crew, or a submarine crew. It's the guys who don't do special, exciting black ops stuff, but who just do the job, who are, I'm sure, told at the beginning of every mission, this one will make a difference, this one will help win the war, and yet their experience is that it's just the same violent horror every time, where they and their friends risk death. Some of them suffer it. And even when the bullets stop flying and things go quiet again, they know that tomorrow they'll be doing the same thing, that there'll be another river to fight their way across, or a mountain to fight their way up, which is the Italian campaign in a nutshell. So for them, there's a sort of endless quality to it. And that's what I mean by the heroism of endurance, of just keeping going, sustained, I suppose, by your friends and by your leader, in this case, the sarge in his section.
And sometimes you've just got to get across a road at night.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic stuff. Well, we will grant you that. And as ever, I will post that and some of the covers on all the socials when this episode comes out. I'll say that both volumes of The Sarge, 1 and 2, are available in hardback from Rebellion, the Treasury of British Comics store, for £19.99 each. You can also get them digitally, £9.99. I'm actually going to say that these ones, you need the hardbacks. They are so lovely. Mm. They've got the extra features. The reproduction, I think, is really very good again. You know, the Treasury are getting very good at reproducing this artwork. It just looks wonderful, doesn't it? They're both fantastic volumes, Garth.
I think so. I think it's just the nicest way to read this story. And I'm so pleased, really, to see them putting this stuff out, because to me, these stories are important. The battle, and then battle action, is really where the revolution in British comics began. And stories like The Sarge, and Johnny Red and Charlie's War and Darkie's Mob and the better known ones are a big part of that. So if there is a period in British comics worthy of this Treasury of British Comics idea, I think this is it.
And how great to have two volumes of Mike Weston artwork and Jerry Finley Day's wonderful writing.
Yes, indeed. I think there are plans, very vague plans, to do more, to go on and collect the Scott Goodall, Phil Gascoigne material. It's a different beast. It's probably about another year and a half, 2 years worth of material, I think. And I hope they do. It's good stuff, but you will notice the difference.
Right.
A different kind of strip with a different approach to storytelling and character.
So do buy these two volumes, and hopefully, as you say, encourage the Rebellion to keep putting out more, because they are fantastic, and I really enjoyed them. They were a tremendous read.
Mm.
Garth, guest projects time, and we sort of stick with Battle Action because, obviously, this will come out on November the 3rd, and I think issue 3 of the current Battle Action series will be out just about then, I think. 3 of 10, is that right?
That's right. Issue 3 continues the Johnny Red story by myself and Keith Burns, and features a one-off Hookjaw story written by Steve White, art by John McCrite. Steve has also provided an absolutely incredible cover featuring Hookjaw locked in battle with a killer whale. Yeah, you won't want to miss this. It's a tremendous looking comic. It really is. And after that, I think the next issue features El Mestizo. That'll be Henry Flint drawing a Rob Williams script. Every issue will have Johnny Red by myself and Keith, and that will go all the way to the end. The 10th issue is all Johnny Red. So that'll finish the story out in what I hope is fine style. I think issue 5 is Dredger. No, I beg your pardon. It's Hellman, myself and Mike Dorey.
Oh, wow. Yes, great.
Yeah. After that, you've got Death Game 99 by Dan Abnett and Tom Foster. You've got Nina Petrova and the Angels of Death, Torin Grunbeck and Paddy Goddard. What am I up to there? Is that 7 or 8? And you've got towards the end, I think issue 9, you've got another Dredger by myself and John Higgins, featuring a boyhood adventure of everyone's favorite psychopath, with particularly lovely art by John. Actually, really tasty stuff.
Fantastic. And as you know, we've talked previously about the previous specials. The number of each run is growing steadily because they are continuing to do well.
Yeah, they are. I mean, involving someone like Brian Vaughan, of course, helps hugely with the, you know, the first issue featuring a story, a Kids Rule OK story by him and Chris Burnham. But it seems as if there's enough interest in this stuff to keep it going. And look, we all want to do more battle action. I'm sure that'll come as no surprise at all. So all I can say is that at the moment, we're talking to Rebellion about doing more. What form that will take, I cannot say for the moment. But I would imagine if we did go on, you would see more of what you've seen to date, with more new writers and artists handling characters that you haven't seen so far. I did just realize, by the way, the one I missed was Major Easy, again written by Rob Williams. Yeah, that would be interesting. Robin Williams, and drawn this time by PJ Holden.
Right. Fantastic stuff. And of course, in issue two, we had John Wagner and Dan Cornwell doing some more HMS Nightshade as well.
That's right. Yeah, good to see that.
Yeah.
I think just to see that continuation of such a good battle action strip.
So, as well as buying the Sarge collections, keep buying the battle action specials as they come out, because, as you say, everybody wants more. So, hopefully, we will get more and more. And also, as you know, again, as this issue comes out, you're back in the prog with Patrick Goddard doing some more Rogue Trooper.
That's right. That's right. I think we're about halfway through that run, or maybe not quite. I can tell you that the last issue of that, which will come out just before the Christmas prog, will be double-sized. Actually, very nearly triple-sized. It's 16 pages, so we've probably got half the prog. But should round that one out nicely. I've really enjoyed writing Rogue. I think he's such a good character to write. And Paddy does such a good job on the art too. He's one of those guys, a bit like Henry Flint, actually working with Henry. He allows you to somehow get in touch with the spirit of classic 2000 AD. You can see Dave Gibbons and Colin Wilson in there in the same way that when you look at Henry's stuff, there's Mick McMahon and Carla Sisquera. On that subject, I should say, actually, that in a couple of weeks, you'll see Robo Hunter versus Strontium Dog by myself and Henry, which is very much in the same spirit as last year's Robo Hunter versus Judge Dredd.
Great stuff. Great to have you back in the prog, Garth. And working with, as you say, with Patrick Goddard after the success of Blighty Valley, which was tremendous as well.
Thank you. Yeah, he's my kind of artist, you know, and Rebellion are my kind of people to work with. Matt Smith on 2000 AD, Oliver Pickles on Battle Action. They're just tremendous. You know that there's almost nothing you have to worry about it, because you know they've already figured it out, or they're worrying about it as we speak. They'll have the answers. Just exactly the kind of editorial people I like to work with.
And I'll just drift off topic to say I also had a great time reading Get Fury by yourself and Jason Burroughs, which has also just wrapped up.
Yeah, that one was good fun. That one's been finished for some time, actually. Jason finished drawing that a couple of years ago. But of course, Marvel were so edgy about the whole Punisher situation at the moment that it took them a while to get it out. But yeah, I enjoyed doing that one. I don't know if I'll have an opportunity to do more Punisher. I'd love to. Marvel seemed to be a bit more receptive to the idea. I think perhaps the fuss over all that has passed. So, certainly if they told me I could, I would. But fingers crossed I'll be doing a bit more Punisher soon. If I don't get to do it, Get Fury is perhaps not the worst goodbye.
Great stuff. Well, Garth, thanks as ever for giving up your time to appear on the Book Club and to talk about such an important comic. I know it was one that you were keen that we get to, and to do the entire Mike Weston and Jerry Finley Day run.
Yeah, it's classic battle action. It really is. It belongs there alongside all those things like Hellman, like Fighting Man and Rat Pack and Crazy Keller. Yes, it can. The strip can hold its head up with the best of them.
Great stuff. And yeah, and it belongs on your shelf, doesn't it? Really, these two volumes are fantastic.
It really does.
Yeah. Great stuff. Thank you again, Garth. And I hope we run into each other at another convention next year with a bit of luck. I might be able to buy you that pint.
I dare say we will. All right, Eamon, you take care of yourself.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone for listening to Mega City Book Club. As ever, follow us on all the socials. Email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, if you've got a book or an artist or creator you'd like to come on and talk about. Find all the links at megacitybookclub.com. And until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's goodbye from me and...
goodbye from me. Cheers.